Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of one of seven Dhamma talks and Sangha discussions from our fall 2017 retreat at Mon Dharma Center in Claverack, New York, from October 19th to October 22nd. Information about future retreats can be found at becoming-buddha.com. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
The talk today is going to be on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, but first we're going to meditate, and I want to talk a little bit about meditation, because and there's really no reason to talk a lot about it, but I should talk a little bit about it. And what Maura was talking about just right now, about why people would want to learn to levitate and transmigrate and all that stuff. I went through that. My first meditation, serious meditation practice that I learned was transcendental meditation. And again, I always got to qualify these things when I'm pointing out the differences and maybe not the extreme usefulness of certain practices. I'm not trying to denigrate, I'm just pointing out the difference. So I had a wonderful teacher that taught me transcendental meditation. She was, even back then, this was 1986 or 7, she was making excuses. That's not true. She was uncomfortable about even the cost associated with learning. Which has gotten quite expensive, and that's kind of ancillary. But the point is that that's often presented in a way that is out of reach for most people. And that's, to me, that always bothered me even from the beginning. I happened to have the money at the time. I think it was $1,200 to learn how to do it. And Maggie, her name was Maggie Schleiter. She's since passed. She was just a wonderful person. Completely sincere and deeply committed in what she was teaching. And so she taught me the initial phase of transcendental meditation, which is a mantra-based meditation. Itself based on something called Kriya Yoga, which itself, that is based on going way back to the Vedas, but greatly modified to get to the point of something called Kriya Yoga. And I won't get into the explanation of all that because I tend to talk too much. So mantra-based meditation is and was effective for me in developing a certain measure of concentration, being repeating this word. And the word, you're told never to divulge your mantra. Mm-hmm. Something awful is going to happen. But I've done it a few times and nothing bad happens. So the word is the word is harem. Nothing bad. Well, I don't know. H-R-I-M, harem. And I was taught that that was a special, and I'm only saying this to give the background on how it became disappointing for me. I was taught that that was a special word that was somehow passed down through my teacher to me in this special ceremony we went to, and it was a completely unique word, only for my use, never to be divulged. And I was, after that initiation, I started studying a little bit about Kriya Yoga, and in Kriya Yoga, there's seven sacred mantras, and there was mine. I told that story about how Maggie was so sincere and so helpful to point out she was confused by the whole thing too. But when I found that out, when I found the inauthenticity of the background of the foundation of this teaching, it greatly affected my practice. I just couldn't be all that serious about it, but I continued anyway.
Did you ever tell Maggie?
No, to me that would have been a sign of it would be throwing it up in her face. You know, so I wouldn't do it. That was best kept to myself until now. So I started developing a group of friends that were also meditators, and it led to some really wonderful associations. I was always interested in the higher levels of transcendental meditation, but I could never afford the different levels. The next level, I think, at that time was $3,000. And if you weren't initiated into the higher levels, you weren't allowed to meditate with the folks that were. And I had formed a meditation group, interestingly enough, in my home, with those of us on the low level, and some of my friends were involved in the upper level called the Siddhis program, SIDDHIS. And those folks, the advanced level, you learned how to levitate during your meditation. You could actually develop such a deep level of concentration that you could arise off your cushion and float around the room. So I had this meditation room down in the basement, And we would meditate first as a group, and then the cities would meditate separately. We'd have to leave, and we'd close the door. And we'd go upstairs and have, you know, cake and coffee and have a great old time. But there they were down there levitating. But I was always a curious type. And even though you were prohibited from even observing the cities as they meditate, I had to take a look. And so...
I was hoping this story was going in that direction.
Yeah, there'd be really nothing to tell if it didn't. So I snuck downstairs in my own house and sneaking around my own house. And I cracked the door slightly to peek in at these meditators. And I saw a group of adults pushing themselves up off the floor. And they considered that levitation. And again, I'm not denigrating anyone, but that was the last time I ever engaged in transcendental meditation. Mm-hmm. It was.
I mean, they were just like going like that?
Yes. And they felt that they were levitating. And it taught me a lot about conditioned thinking. And also to be very, very careful about what I practice. Now, to qualify all that, and this is really the important point of how things can get taken from their pure form, and because of what we want to apply to it and the reasons for adapting it into certain ways, we corrupt the practice itself. Transcendental meditation was founded by an incredible gentleman named Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Most of you have heard his name. He spent most of his Hindu influence practice somewhat isolated and with a very small group. And he achieved a certain level of enlightenment. And he decided, much like when the Buddha said, I looked out on the world and I saw the world was aflame, he started getting an understanding of the great conflicts in the world, and he really felt that at some point in human history, very soon, that if something didn't intervene, we were going to blow ourselves off the planet. And so he left this very comfortable life, again, much like Siddhartha, with the intention, with the knowing, or at least the thinking, that if I could teach enough people how to meditate, maybe I can save the planet, I can save us from that great violence. And that's what motivated him. And so he did leave that little, I can't remember the name of the town that he lived in. And he really lived almost as a cave dweller. And so he started just teaching. He just put it out there. Again, much like Siddhartha. He didn't go on the Mike Douglas show. Anybody remember the Mike Douglas show? He eventually did, and he eventually was on good old Mike Douglas. But he just wanted to teach meditation to save the world. I think he succeeded along with the Buddha. There's been many studies that have shown that when a certain amount of people meditate, when they've done this in very violent cities, pick a city, they've done the study in every city, when a certain number of people get to meditate, the crime rate plummets during the time they're meditating and a short while afterwards. So we know that there's an effect. And I really believe that if it wasn't for Maharishi and then other people that developed other meditation practices, including Buddhist meditations, have had that effect. They've had enough of a calming effect on the world that at least we're still here. I don't know if it's going to continue. So,
and he ended up somewhere in the Midwest.
Iowa.
Yeah, there's a...
Fairfield, Iowa.
There's a transcendental, I don't know what they call it, but it's a university for a pretty wonderful place. The problem is, as transcendental meditation spread, as greed, aversion, and delusion intervened, it became quite a powerful business with a bottom line mentality. Again, I'm not denigrating, this really is the truth. I think the initiation now is around $3,500 to start. It's heavily advertised. It's not something that Maharishi passed, I can't remember how long ago. It was something that he was very disappointed in the organization that had grown around him. I won't mention the name of the person who was the president of him. If I mention him, you know him because he's run for president a few times. They had quite a split. Well, I wouldn't even say it because Maharishi wouldn't see it as a split. This other gentleman would, but Maharishi basically washed his hands of the whole thing. And they continue today. A long, long story to get to what I really wanted to talk about that was inspired by what Morris said and some of my past memories. It's easy to take something as simple and direct and holistic and have it become corrupted. And that was a good story to show that. The same thing has happened within Buddhist meditation. The Buddha taught a very simple meditation, which is what we use, shamatha vipassana meditation. It's mentioned in a few different ways, but not extensively, because it doesn't need a lot of, what we do doesn't need a lot of instruction, does it? It's very simple and direct. More than instruction, the Buddha taught the underlying principle for why we meditate, to deepen concentration. And that's taught in the Samadhi Sutta. It's taught in the, I can't think of the name, it starts with a J, but it's where he talks about the importance of developing shamatha vipassana in tandem. And I've given that talk in Frenchtown. Meaning that they're both components of developing concentration. Samatha vipassana, that's what we practice. There's a few suttas, primarily the Satipatthana Sutta and Anapanasati Sutta, that have been misinterpreted and misapplied to say that the Buddha taught something other than Samatha vipassana meditation. Because in both of those suttas, I just gave the talk on the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. And so even the words give a little direction to what is to follow in the teaching. The four foundations of mindfulness teach the foundations of mindfulness. And in that sutta, he teaches again the different things that can occur while we're meditating. And he begins that with saying, when you might find yourself breathing deeply. And then he might say, or you might find yourself breathing shallowly. Or you might have this type of breath or that type of breath. Always come back to the sensation of breathing, no matter how your breath is presenting itself. Many of the modern adaptations have taken that as instructions that we should conjure up or manufacture a long breath and meditate on a long breath. You can see the distraction in that, isn't there? Rather than just using the simple breath technique to develop a well concentrated mind. He further gets into meditation on the charnel grounds. And so there's whole schools that teach that you should spend your whole meditation practice contemplating what happens when you die and the breakup of the body, getting very intricate into worms eating this and that. The Buddha taught that to just describe and become disenamored with the body, with that self-identification. Because look what happens to it. It happens to all of us. So people have made a meditation practice out of contemplating those things that are included in the four foundations of mindfulness. Contemplation is not meditation. Contemplation is something different, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Contemplation does not increase concentration. Contemplation doesn't increase concentration.
Even while he was alive, he changed his instructions, because there was a time when he would, you know, go off on a retreat by himself and then leave the Sangha in the hands of Ananda and tell him that there are to contemplate the contemplate the awfulness of the body or something like that.
Yep.
And
which is really a teaching on impermanence, but
right. But again, the bhikkhus would go and run with that, and
yep,
to the point where they would get so disgusted with their physical body that they would kill themselves.
Yeah, this is absolutely true.
Yeah, Buddha comes back and says, the Sangha seems to be a bit depleted.
it was too an immediate experience of impermanence, even for the Buddha.
Yeah. And I read the sutta as him saying at the end, well, maybe we should change these instructions, because
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be working. People kill themselves.
Yeah, I mean, we're laughing about that. And really what, in the way that I read it, is the Buddha realized that he needs to be very, very specific about what meditation is, mm-hmm, and what the insight that's developed. Samatha vipassana. Vipassana means insight. The insight that is developed in meditation that brings insight to impermanence. So the meditation is not for contemplating even impermanence. It's for deepening concentration, so that within the framework of the Eightfold Path, we understand, we gain insight, and very specific insight, into impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and resulting dukkha. Now, there's other, when you read the Satipatthana Sutta in context, and also understanding that it's part of developing the Eightfold Path, it becomes clear that the Buddha is only saying, these are the kind of things that will come up in meditation. When they come up, come back to the sensation of breathing. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the instruction for all of meditation is included in the title. And yet it's been one of the most misunderstood teachings. I got two emails in the last couple of weeks from, I can almost feel the breathlessness of the students. I just came across a sutta. What does it mean? Anapanasati means mindfulness of the breath. Even the title of the sutta says, this is what I'm teaching, mindfulness of the breath. And in that sutta, it gets very lengthy about different things that can arise, beginning with that reference to the different breaths. And so that's been taken that we should have contemplative practices on the breath. Then he gets into other things that arise that directly relate to five clinging aggregates and dependent origination. In other words, there's a line in there that says, be sensitive of pleasure. And that's taken as that, well, we should contemplate the nature of pleasure. Be sensitive to form. Be sensitive to perceptions. And so now meditations are developed to meaning that we should now be contemplating. What does perception mean? And use our meditation to try to figure out and put labels on perceptions and feelings and other concepts. When you read the Anapanasati Sutta in the proper context, beginning with the title, you realize that the Buddha is saying, when you're sensitive to pleasure, when you notice pleasure arise, come back to the sensation of breathing. When you notice the distraction of being associated with form, or when you feel like you want to contemplate your own form, don't continue the contemplation, come back to the sensation of breathing. And in this way, meditation is used for exactly why the Buddha taught it, to deepen concentration. And we don't get distracted by the things that are addressed in the rest of the Dhamma. And again, you have to have a broad overview of what the Buddha taught and why he taught it in order to interpret any singular sutta. But these are suttas that get very specific, and that people that don't understand the entire context then want to gravitate to saying, well, let's make a practice out of this. Because then you can, it's a very, when I'm talking about subtle strategies that allow us to continue to ignore ignorance, this is a perfect example. Because then we can create a so-called Buddhist practice and even a meditation practice and use that practice to ignore ignorance, because we're not engaging with the rest of the path. Our meditation practice itself then becomes a distraction. And so the reason why I'm saying that is to reinforce why I teach what I teach and why it's the only meditation the Buddha ever taught, to deepen concentration. The insight that we gain to these other things are gained through the entire Eightfold Path. Is that clear? Does anybody have any questions or even comments on that? It's okay if you do. Start with one.
Did they give any instructions? I mean, when we were doing Qigong, just downstairs, just now, about to focus on breath and on your belly and your stomach.
That's a good question. The Buddha never taught in meditation. Now, it doesn't mean that because the Buddha didn't teach it in meditation that it's not wise and skillful to do it in Qigong. But as a simple concentration practice, the Buddha never taught to focus your breath on any part of your body. He never taught to breathe into a feeling or to tension or anything like that. And the reason why is for a completely practical reason. The instruction to breathe into your foot or breathe into a pain in your ankle is impractical because we can only breathe into our lungs. And if I'm concerned, if I have a sensation in my body, a pain arises in my ankle, and I notice it in my meditation, I say, okay, now I'm going to breathe into my ankle. What am I doing? I'm allowing the distraction of the pain rule my meditation practice. And it may even help in an imaginative way to relieve the pain, or maybe even a practical way, but it's not meditation. So if you have a pain in your ankle and you want to use your breath to address it, that's great, but don't do it in meditation. Do your meditation, then go sit again and breathe into your foot. But in a practical way, our breath only goes into our lungs, and for a very specific physiological reason. And I remember, I'm going to mention this only because a student says, well, we breathe through our skin, and we do, don't we? But that's not respiration. The oxygen is diffused through our skin and only into a very thin layer of skin. It doesn't get dispersed through the body. And again, it's not solely for respiration that we focus on the breath. It's simply a practical, very practical tool to be mindful of. If we just focus on our breath alone without introducing any concepts or contemplative practices or breathing it, trying to get our breath throughout our body, which we can't do, then it'll be a useful tool for developing concentration. And that's why the Buddha taught that. That's why I teach it. I practice most of all those other meditation practices in my meditation career. And some of them develop quite pleasant altered states, but none of them develop concentration. And it's even because of those pleasant altered states that it seems like, well, this is a great thing to do, isn't it? An altered state is just another word for a good use of distraction in meditation. That, and again, it doesn't mean that outside of meditation, you know, feel free to do what you want, but just be mindful that what the Buddha taught and what we practice as part of the Eightfold Path is Shamatha Vipassana meditation. Maura?
I'm just going to add two things, not necessarily related. So I'm completely in agreement with the purpose of meditation. Completely. There's no conflict there. I'm just going to add two qualifying things. Noticing the breath. So when we inspire and expire, the entire body moves as a result of the lungs filling and emptying. So you can feel the sensation of that musculoskeletal movement throughout the body. It is where the body is all connected. So when it's saying notice the breath in the body, not meditation, I'm just saying, noticing the breath in the body, if one is very still and quiet, that sensation of the body expanding and contracting can be felt anywhere in the body. So we're not breathing in our neck, but our neck is certainly all these inspiratory musculature is moving. So that's just an observation of the subtle way that the body is responding. So it's just a quietness, it's just an observation, an embodiment. So the breath is not everywhere, but the body is moving in response to inhalation, exhalation. And so that's just a comment. And then in terms of recognizing tension in the body, so not necessarily in meditation because I can understand the distraction, but if one is, okay, there's some tightness, but being, let's just say, say when thoughts have arisen, if a recurrent thought arises, if a persistent thought arises, stay with it for a moment, recognize its impermanence, and return your awareness to the breath. So, I don't know, but sometimes a recurrent sensation will arise in my body, recognizing, staying with it for a minute, one is able to see the impermanent nature of that sensation and return awareness to the breath. So it's not like I'm, you know, one is going to breathe into the foot or something, but like if there's tension in the back shoulder, kind of just recognizing that, it will soften the mind a little bit. Usually what I find is that's where there's some selfing involved. I'm tightening up around. I'm lost in thought. And it's just kind of like a signal. So I know, you know, there may be some discrepancy there, and I don't mean to throw something extra into to make cause confusion. So I wish I hadn't said that. But that's all I'm saying, that being aware of sensations in the body and recognizing their impersonal, impermanent nature brings awareness to the three marks of existence.
Yes, it can. Thank you, Moore. The what I'm pointing to is that we can get caught up in too much analysis of that. And just not to pick on words, when I say be mindful of it for a moment or two is different than a minute. And maybe I should be even more, I should say be mindful of it for a split second and come back. I wouldn't put the time frame on it, but I think a moment is usually interpreted as just for a moment and come back to the sensation of breathing. And even what Moore is talking about, to be mindful of the expansion and contraction of your chest and your body or your neck, if you find that helpful, that's wonderful. But it's you could find that distracting simply by trying to notice it too much.
And I was body, suggesting to do it in meditation.
Yeah,
I was just saying that we, you know, the breath is, there is a sensation there.
Yep. and be mindful of the breath. If you happen to notice the arising or the expansion and contraction of your chest cavity, and that proves to be a point of concentration for you, that's great. You know, some people come to me as students say that I find counting very helpful, either in reverse or 1 to 10, and come back to it. That's a taught practice, and my response is exactly this. If you find that to help with your concentration, continue with it. And be mindful of at some point it might be a distraction. And one of the reasons why I don't teach it is I found it, when I tried it, to be a distraction, because I would often be overly mindful of when I'm getting to 10, when I'm at 8. And even in that split second, I'm losing my concentration. You see what I'm saying? So, but some people do find it a useful tool. If you do, please use it. As a general rule, what I found to be best, many years of meditation trying just about everything out there, what I found to be most effective for me is when I found what the Buddha taught, which was shamatha vipassana meditation. And when I finally understood what he taught and why he taught it, it was one of the great reliefs of my life. It was like finally getting past alcohol and drugs. It really was that. Because now my meditation method had a useful focus where I didn't really understand what the hell I was doing for all those years. I couldn't figure out what's the usefulness in doing this and doing that. But as soon as I integrated shamatha vipassana meditation into my practice, it then took on meaning and purpose. And I will say that after many, many years of meditation without developing concentration, as soon as I started engaging with this, I actually noticed my concentration increase. And just about every one of you have said the same thing. Very quickly you notice your concentration increasing without doing anything else. So again, there's my talk on meditation. I think it's, as a part of a meditation retreat, I should probably mention it once besides just to do it. So there it is. Again, any questions or comments on it?
Just yes, one sir. Thing that came to mind for me when Ron was telling that story is I found this to be true for myself. So I found that I tend to see things very black and white. So I find that it's easy to take something that seems to make sense for me and take it to the extreme. So I think the way that in my practice that initially came up was hearing some of the teachings and thinking and having a misunderstanding of them and saying, okay, I can't have feelings. I can't feel emotions. Yeah. I have to be very careful to not engage with that. So the reason why I bring it up is just because I've realized even more so as my practice has continued where I'm doing that. And I think on this retreat, I've actually started to look at it and say, I can't take this stuff so seriously.
That's right.
Like, there's a practicality and a reality to this. Because I found myself envisioning that enlightenment or awakening somehow looked like, I don't know, almost zombie-like or something. Like, I can't just enjoy life. Like, yep. I'm not allowed to hang out with friends anymore and just have fun and laugh. And then realizing how ridiculous that is.
Yeah.
But just starting to frame in and understand that what that can look like is to live a normal life.
It's the middle way.
Exactly.
Middle way.
And so, not one way so much this way or that way. So that's just been something that I've realized even more so on this retreat.
Thank you for saying that. The most powerful strategy to continue to ignore ignorance is gaining an extreme view and then convincing yourself that it's reasonable.
Right.
You know, including, and look, many, many people, when they start really understanding the implications of the Dhamma, go to that extreme view. This is annihilation. There's going to be nothing left to me. When it's just the opposite. What you're letting go of is nothing, and what you're gaining is everything.
And my wife is really good at reminding me when I'm doing it, which is really good. And I also find that when she does it initially, I defend it really strongly.
Yeah.
And then after a few weeks, I kind of go, oh, wow. She's like,
weeks?
You got to straighten that up.
Yeah.
Danielle does have a way of really living the Dhamma.
How's your wife?
I'm working on making the windows small.
A little bit of advice from the female in the room.
I'll let her know you guys told me that. She'll
appreciate it. We're going to fast track you here.
But I think that everybody goes through that process. I know I went through that process in the dawn, and that's what I was trying to just talk with Carrie about initially. Like, it takes a lot of time to integrate what are these practices, how do I use them skillfully? And it's only through direct observation that one begins to see. We can understand it on that level and then take it into practice and reflecting out of meditation on what the results are.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. The framework for how to meditate and everything else is included in the teachings. It's when we start adapting or accommodating or embellishing the teachings that we get into trouble. You know, the pure teachings are just that. They're pure, they're simple, they're direct. Anybody can engage them without too much confusion, except we have this thing called a conditioned mind. And the conditioned mind wants to say, well, maybe I need to make this different. Or that conditioned mind will see things that aren't even there, such as the misapplication of, pick one, dependent origination, anapanasati, four foundations of mindfulness. That all comes from a conditioned mind that needs to do that and create an extreme experience where there's nothing extreme about sitting and being mindful of your breath, isn't it? And it's in that simplicity, that avoidance of extreme views, that it works. So it's not a question of, well, it works this way, but it seems like it works that way because it feels good or everybody's doing it. It works because it's what an awakened human being found works. And that's where I put, when I could finally trust in that, again, that's where the great freedom and the great inspiration, Larry was talking, notice my excitement, I guess you all do. It's because I'm recognizing the truth of something. To me, that is exciting, it's inspiring. Here it is, 2,600 years ago, this guy figured it all out. Not something, he figured it all out. And then he spent 45 years teaching it. Who the hell am I to put my own views into it? And I excuse the strong language, but I'm just using it for emphasis. And why would I want to do it? And one of the things that I realized when I finally saw what the Buddha taught and understood it was that is exactly what I was doing for the previous 20 years. I was trying to make the different dharmas fit my view, and they were trying to make my view fit their view, which was a contrary view to what the Buddha's view was. So I got increasingly confused, increasingly frustrated, and I was quickly getting to the point where I was going back to Catholic Church. Or I had to find something that was working for me, and that's when I looked at the Pali Canon, and that's when it made sense, and that's when I found out what right meditation, the Buddha teaches right meditation. And the implication is there's such a thing as wrong meditation, even during his time. The Buddha studied two of the most advanced meditation techniques of his time. And they both taught contemplative and conceptual applications of time spent on a cushion. And he rejected both of them. They don't lead to the goal. And it was only when out of that frustration that he remembered a simple and direct meditation practice that a five-year-old boy practiced. He did. 29 years earlier. I don't remember the time frame, but quite a bit earlier. He remembered that simple mindfulness of the breath allowed him to calm himself when he was frustrated. And that's the method that he employed to facilitate his awakening, and it's what he taught for 45 years. And it's what we're going to do right now, if I shut up.
John, can I just ask, I'm sorry, this is the last comment I will try to make for today. And it takes concentration and increased mindfulness and understanding of right view, right intention, to see that in practice. So going back to Mark's comment and my own experience, it wasn't because of embellishment that I was trying to take on other Tibetan and practices. It was simply to begin to see this and integrate it. It takes time. And I think so, to have a sense of compassion and patience and gentleness and I'm not doing anything wrong here, it just takes time. Maybe for you, you know, you had been you know, in this search, and you have a good concentrated mind, and you're able to see through things. But it took time to get there.
Oh, it absolutely did.
So it's, you know, it's not so much that I think we're trying, because even just practicing straight Samatha Vipassana, trying to, you know, to have, try to hold right view and understand something and all this, it is, you know, in the middle of whatever chaotic life, you know, that we do find ourselves in, it just takes some time and to really understand it deeper. I'm trying to encourage a gentleness, and everybody goes at their own pace and does the best that they can.
I think if you take what I teach in context, one of the things I say out of almost every session is we need to be gentle with ourselves. So, of course, that applies to developing a meditation practice. And you said something that about you embellishing. When I'm talking about embellishing, what I'm talking about is not our intentional embellishment, meaning this is what it is and I'm going to embellish it. It's what's usually taught. Most meditations are taught as that are embellishing what the Buddha taught. So it's not our own intent. I mean, it might be our intention to change it in some way. But it's usually something that's taught to us, is what I'm saying. So, of course, we always be gentle with ourselves. It does take time. And the way to move through that as quickly as possible, let me say it another way. If we're going to practice the Buddha's Dhamma, we might as well practice the meditation method that he taught. I mean, that just makes sense. And that really is the essence of being gentle with ourselves, isn't it? The essence of gentleness is to kind of get to it. And when we fall, or when we falter, or when our practice isn't perfect, is when we try to be gentle, but also learn from that. We don't judge ourselves. We had a great talk with Mark the other day, too, about when we find that we're not right within the framework of the Eightfold Path, it's not the time to start whipping ourselves. It's at that point that we should be very gentle. And because that allows us to recognize, wait a minute, I need to fine-tune this in a certain way. How do I fine-tune it? Look to what the Buddha taught. That's why he taught what he taught. Not to gain followers, not to get true believers, but out of the great compassion married with great wisdom to get to it. To me, the most loving and compassionate thing that was ever exemplified was something an awakened human being did. He taught out of great compassion. But he also, when he found people deviating from the path, he directly addressed it because he knew that was the most compassionate way to be, too, to not beat around the bush. And sometimes he'd use the translated language is somewhat harsh to us. He would call people out as being foolish, but not in a hurtful way, because he understood in that setting that that was the most compassionate thing that he could do, to seriously make the point, you're being foolish in what you're doing. And some of these were well-known people that had left his sangha and started teaching and embellished Dhamma, and he would call them back in. I've told stories about this often. He'd hear of it, and he'd call them back in. And in front of the whole Dhamma, the whole sangha, he would use those types of words, but not to hurt people, because he understood how important it was to remain authentic to the Dhamma. And he did that because of great compassion. He wanted people to end their own contributions to suffering, and he knew the direct way. Larry, you have your hand up.
No, I was just thinking about what we were talking about earlier about the use of the word abandonment, to abandon these things, and how that sometimes feels difficult for people.
Yeah.
It makes, because of that. But that's what he was asking, to just let go of that.
Yeah.
And in this regard here, going back to what Mark was saying also, people don't like the word annihilate. It's engraved in a stone in my garden. It came out of the context of a poem by a man named Andrew Marvel. It says, but it was about this. It was about this quiet in the mind. It's it lifts right out, annihilating all that's made to a green thought in a green shape.
Yeah,
and it's just, people look at that, and I'm almost sorry it's there sometimes, because they and that's not what it is at all.
It's not.
It's just quieting the mind so that you can do this work.
Yeah. Thank you. Would you send me the poem, please? Email it to me.
Annihilating all that's made. I mean, what we're making.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just something, it's a monkey mind. Some people call it a monkey mind, but it's a making, making, making.
Yeah. We are. We're making it. We're making this mangled monkey mind out of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And that mind is incredibly protective. And so when it hears a word like even abandonment, abandon your own mind, it's frightening. It's horrifying at times. And yet you're abandoning nothing. You're abandoning the cause of your own ill ease.
And it also speaks to the need to, you know, you have awareness, cut it off. You know what I mean? Like, I think we enable ourselves when we go, I'll cut it off a little bit, and then a little bit, and I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I'm on a path, I'm whatever. When there, you know, when there's true awareness, and I am not something I'm skillful at yet myself, but the whole idea of cut it off, just you know what you know. And don't bullshit yourself. Cut it off and move on. Jen said that was bullshit.
As opposed to analyzing it and getting rid of it and all
that.
Cut, because that is the continued distraction of an ignorant mind.
Right.
And we've created all kinds of strategies to even justify doing that.
Right.
To me, especially when we use it in meditation, contemplation is simply analysis that is now taking place during meditation when we should be deepening concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And you point directly to the two suttas that I mentioned. The Buddha saying, when you're sensitive to pleasure, cut it off. Come back to the sensation of breathing. When you're sensitive to perceptions, don't try to figure out perceptions. Cut it in meditation. Cut it off. It's off our cushion within the framework of the Eightfold Path that we develop an understanding of perceptions.
That's the piece that I missed, by the way.
Glad you finally got it.
I just cut everything off.
or annihilate it. I mean, those are such powerful words that we have resistance to those types of things. But it really, it's like calling someone who's foolish in the right context, you're foolish. Because it's the most compassionate thing to do. It gets to the heart of the matter. It ends the possibility. And most of the people that the Buddha said, you're foolish, they got it right at that instant.
Right.
There's two incidents where they didn't get it. One was Devadatta, the story of his life is just devastating because of his continued ignorance of what the Buddha was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I won't get into the other one. Because
it's like that's abandon all minds that have left the cushion.
Yeah, yeah. Or abandon all mindless activities. You know?
But I think Paul's point is good, too. What he got it, but he cut everything off.
Yeah, again, but you talked about that. You realize the extreme nature
during
of
meditation.
So we do that with all...
Right,
exactly. It's almost like, this is why I say awakening, the best description is full human maturity.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you tell a child to do something, and they're going to do that to the extreme to show you how wrong you are, rather than keep it in the context. Yeah, right, for this minute, I need to be quiet because we're eating dinner.
Right.
I'm not going to talk to her, I'm not going to open my mouth, I'm not going to talk to you.
Adults do that too.
Well, yeah. Adults that are yet awakened because they're not quite mature. So we'll take anything that offends our...
Right.
Self-referential ego self, and the reaction is usually an extreme reaction, and we usually do it to make a point how powerful my ego self is, instead of recognizing it's the ego that's the problem. While I was meditating, I was contemplating some of the things we talked about previously, just for a moment, and I came back to my breath, and just for clarity's sake, so there's no confusion between what Matt is teaching in Qigong and something that Lorna said. So, and you'll correct me or explain further in just a moment. Matt understands this way much better than I do, but my little understanding of Qi and oxygen is they're two different things, and they have two different functions in the body. I think you can accurately say that oxygen is subservient to Qi, but maybe not. And the mind is a useful tool for moving qi through the body. And another useful way of moving qi through the body is through a knowledgeable and skillful practitioner. That's the whole kind of point behind acupuncture, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So just to make that distinction, So, but would you?
Yeah, and that Qigong and comes from Chinese medicine. So when we're practicing Qigong, it's not in a Buddhist context. It's in the context of health and working with the subtle energy systems of the body, of the human body, of which there are many from all different cultures. So the acupuncture channels or the qi channels of the body are one form of subtle energy. And everything in nature is considered to be a pattern of qi. So oxygen, blood, lymph, tissue, bone, muscle, thoughts, emotions, all of those things are considered patterns of qi. So when we're practicing qigong, it's for the very specific, in the very specific context of supplementing and nourishing the body. So,
but there's no separation because of the underlying philosophy between the mind and the body.
Right. So in the process of doing that, in the process of practicing qigong, the body relaxes, the mind relaxes, circulation improves, all of those things take place on their own. So as we develop concentration, also through, you know, noticing subtle sensations and movements in the body that were previously invisible or you were unaware of, by practicing qigong, that the concentration that it requires to notice those things improves. And then there's a more inclusive, holistic experience of being in a body. And that's where we are. That's where we do Dhamma practice. That's where we do our lives, in our bodies. So the better that we get to know our bodies, the better that we get to know how the body's working, that the body's working, develop a stronger relationship with that process, the richer, deeper life experience that we'll have. So that's why Qigong.
Thank you.
Practice is
what we're doing. The reason why Matt and I are such effective partners at Cross River Meditation Center is because the two practices are very, very complementary. And even though they do have a slightly different underlying philosophy, there's no basic contradiction in that philosophy. And the idea of using those movements to bring mindfulness of where you are, meaning in the body, is exactly the same thing as we're doing when we're mindful of our breath. We're bringing ourselves into what's occurring within the five clinging aggregates, including the form. So, just as a point of clarity, thank you very much.
That's right. And that life as it's occurring includes subtle energy movement in the body. So whether we're aware of it or not, that's happening. It's possible for us to become aware of that. And to our own benefit, I'd say.
Well, definitely. And to the benefit of the Dhamma practice, and just to, you know, just to make the point, Matt teaches Tuesdays and Thursdays before our Tuesdays and Thursdays meditation class, and it really is a great complementary practice. Lorna will attest to that when it comes on Tuesday. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the explanation, too. This session is scheduled to end in 10 minutes. So we have a decision to make as a Sangha. We're either going to have this afternoon off, there's nothing scheduled, or we're going to have a teaching on the Anatta Lakana Sutta. Or I think we can go to 12 o'clock or thereabouts and get it in this morning. And I don't even like to use that word, let's get it in. It's perfectly okay with me if we have it this afternoon, but But I also think it's important to have that downtime too. I think you'll all agree, even if it's just to take a walk around. So is it okay if we just go to 12 o'clock and see how we do?
Yeah.
Okay. To that end, I know I say this every time, and we have such wonderful discussions. They really are. It's remarkable what the things that come up. But let me, if there's questions about what I'm teaching, what I'm reading, please get my attention. But as far as discussions, let's leave that until the end and see if we have time. And if not, then we can have the discussion as part of our evening session tonight. Okay, thank you. So I've kind of given the background to all this. Well, let me get to the right sutta first. I almost started the Four Noble Truths again. Mm-hmm. By the way, if anybody hasn't noticed, my eyes aren't getting any better. All an experience of impermanence. That's right. I'm not worried about it. The sutta I mentioned before where the Buddha teaches Shamatha Vipassana meditation is called the Yoganatha Sutta, and it's in the book. I was contemplating that before, too. I just want to bring it up. Where am I here? There it is. So this is the second sutta the Buddha ever gave. And you can see that, much like we're doing here, the Buddha was discussing the Dhamma with the five friends that he had befriended during his wandering around northern India. And certain questions arose. And this sutta is in response to what arose. Ram asked a really good question. How come the Buddha didn't include the five clinging aggregates in his first teaching? It's because it wasn't contextually relevant at that time. He didn't see the opening in the people's minds yet to teach that. So now he's seen an opening to discuss and explain the not self characteristic and the five clinging aggregates. This is again, the time frame is not exact. Some scholars will say this is about 2 weeks. Some people will say you can't really know when he taught it. Most agree that this is the second discourse the Buddha ever gave. My feeling is, in placing it in context, is that it is about, you know, maybe 2 weeks after he gave that first teaching. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. There he addressed a group of five, they're now bhikkhus, they've taken vows to follow the Buddha. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering. And one could have it be any form desired and stress-free. The Buddha's saying that if you have, the only way something can be claimed as me is to actually have control over it. If we have no control over it, how could it be you? How could it even be a component of you? And one could have it be any form desired and stress-free. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering, and none could have it be any form desired and stress-free. Bhikkhus, feeling is not self, as perceptions are not self. Now he's talking about the five clinging aggregates. Fabrications are not self. Consciousness is not self. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one can direct these aggregates as one wished. I think it was Mary or Liz that brought up, so what happens when you awaken about, I'm sorry.
We're going to have to move.
Well, it's your proximity that's really the problem. So what happens to the five clinging aggregates upon awakening? They're still there, but because there's no clinging nature to them, they're not a vehicle for suffering. But clinging to them creates the vehicle for suffering. Since these are not self, they can only lead to suffering, and no one can have these aggregates be as they wish when they're clinging aggregates. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent? How do you perceive it? The next line says the five replied, but I should say the 21 replied. Impermanent, Venerable Sir. You left out the Venerable Sir part. Can you do it again? Just let me see how it feels.
Venerable Sir.
Thank you.
Venerable Sir.
Now, that Venerable Sir replied, now, is what is impermanent painful or pleasant?
Painful.
Boy. Venerable. Painful. You can leave that out now.
I'm not saying that.
Painful, venerable sir. Now is what is impermanent, what is painful, since subject to change. Is this even fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? Are you sincere in your reply? It isn't, is it? Why would I want to claim ownership of and identify myself with anything that's impermanent? Look at the great pitfalls I've created for my own well-being.
Now, to me, it's like one and you're trying to make one and one make three. You know,
exactly.
It just doesn't
make any sense to a reasonable, well-informed mind. They replied, "No, venerable." Let me read it again. I said, "Let's not get into too much discussion." And it's a lack of a well-concentrated mind that I just went there. Now, what is impermanent, what is painful, since subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, venerable sir. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent?
No.
All are impermanent. And again, that paragraph, he's specifically referring to the five clinging aggregates. They're all impermanent. Now, what is impermanent? What is painful since subject to change? Is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, it's not. So, bhikkhus, any kind of form whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it actually is, be regarded as, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. Any type, any attempt to establish ourselves in any impermanent object, event, view, or idea, notion, doctrine, is prone to confusion, delusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering because it's rooted in ignorance. And how should it be regarded? This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Getting ahead of myself. And so it follows that any kind of feeling whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of determination, any kind of determination referring to an assumption, a fabrication, any kind of fabrication, any kind of consciousness, whatever. And again, the Buddha is referring to consciousness rooted in ignorance. Any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it actually is, be regarded as, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has heard the truth sees it in this way, they find estrangement in form. Estrangement meaning that there's no identification left. It's strange to me. It's like meeting someone that you've never met before or seeing something you've never seen before. It's strange to you. There's no identification left at all. They find estrangement in form. They find estrangement in feeling. They find estrangement in perception. They find estrangement in determinations or fabrications. They find estrangement in consciousness. So we could just as easily say they find no clinging to the feeling. There's no clinging to the perception, no clinging to the fabrication, and no clinging to the consciousness. But yet those components are still there, like Mary or Liz brought up last night. But they're part of an awakened human being, and they're neither one of the five aggregates is now being used as a vehicle for further ignorance, or to continue to establish further ignorance. The Buddha continues, when they find estrangement, passion fades out. The passion for what? The passion for continued self-establishment. And how do we achieve it? What happens? With estrangement, it fades out. With disassociation, disidentification, the release from clinging, passion fades out. It's a natural occurrence of the recognition of developing right view. Develop through right view. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. And again, the question that would often arise from someone that doesn't quite understand the Dhamma, do you mean I have a passionless existence after that? Remember the context. It's just the passion for continuing to maintain that which can only lead to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. That's the passion that fades out. And passion for a meaningful life simply arises as a natural occurrence of letting go of everything that is unauthentic.
So you don't need to do the fire sermon.
I'm going to do it anyway. I have passion for it.
Because we've already realized.
Well, remember that. I mean, you're right, Moore. This is the second of the three cardinal discourses. Is it gets right to it, and then everything the Buddha would teach is in this overall context, and then of course in the overall context of Four Noble Truths and Dependent Origination. I'm almost done with the sutta, so I'm just going to go back to the beginning, and then I'll read through, maybe. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. When liberated, there is knowledge that they are liberated. I have to comment. We know it. It's obvious to an awakened human being that they're awakened, because there's nothing, there's that veil of ignorance is now gone. There's nothing to block awareness. They understand. Birth is exhausted, the integrated, and again, it's usually translated as the holy life. The integrated life, meaning integrated with the Eightfold Path, the integrated life has been lived out. All that can be done is done. Of this, there is no more beyond. Those of you that heard the last teaching I gave on the Dhammadina Sutta, where the Dhammadina teaches her husband, he understands, but his last question to Dhammadina is, what's after that? What's after awakening? And she says, again, that it's your questions that are confusing you. Of this, there is no more beyond. Again, some people would, in some Buddhist factions, say that points to annihilation. The Buddha's own life shows that that's not true. There's nothing beyond this teaching. There's nothing beyond awakening, meaning it's enough. And isn't it enough? Imagine having the quality of mind, and again, it's coming soon, that you have no issues with yourself or the world around you. There's nothing beyond that. Or how could there be? Life just unfolds and you're mindfully present. I said I wasn't going to interrupt this, but no, I'm going to conclude the sutta without interrupting it again. Thankfully, it's just a short sentence, so I can actually do it. Now, during this discourse, this is just a beautiful line, though. Again, I don't want to be flippant about it, so let me not. I'm going to relay the background, though. The Buddha just gave his teachings to the five friends that they had spent years and years of arduous and severe ascetic practices trying to gain understanding. In these two simple teachings, look what happened. Now during this discourse, the hearts and minds of those bhikkhus were liberated from craving and aversion and all deluded thinking. The end of the sutta. Hearing things and seeing things in the proper context, their minds were liberated. And in a very short period of time, Kandana had already awakened during the first sutta, but in a very short period of time, seeing things as they are, as they clearly are, the other four buddies of the Buddha awakened. They became the foundation for the Sangha, and the true establishment of Buddhist lineage. And the reason why I'm saying that is because we are continuing that lineage today, right here. And the reason why is because we're practicing an authentic Dhamma, which is the only way that an authentic lineage could be established, isn't it? Through the authentic Dhamma. When I started the retreat, and like I started the last retreat, this is very similar to what the Sangha was like 2,600 years ago. And it's because the teachings are exactly the same, or as close as they can be. And we're having the same experience. Many of you may not have the complete realization that the bhikkhus did at the time, but you inwardly have that realization of the importance of what the Buddha just taught and how it explains the Dhamma. And some of you probably really get it, don't you? So there's a lot more to that in my commentary that I think I've probably given 100 times, so I'm not going to read the rest of it. You can if you want later on today, but let's have a discussion about the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. First things, are there any questions about it? Ron?
Well, actually, a comment. this answers my question from yesterday. He addresses the five main arguments directly and immediately.
Yep.
In his second discourse. That answers my question. Why did people come up with that, even with the term, when it obviously was not something that they, unless it was already the five being aggregates or the five aggregates were already like an established way of thinking at that time.
Some of that might have been part of the overwhelmingly massive information that's included in the Vedas, because the Buddha studied those.
Right.
So there, and I'm speculating. I don't know that, but the concept did have to come from somewhere, didn't it? And a lot of the Buddha's teachings related to the common spiritual concepts. Karma is a great example of that. In a way, simply for communication reasons, for convenience sake. But he taught them in different ways than they were ever taught before. So again, it was just a way of communicating. And so the context had now arisen between the first teachings and the second discourse in which to teach five clinging aggregates. When I thought a little bit more about what you said, I contemplated it last night, that it would have been out of context to go right into this teaching without seeing what was occurring without the discussion, like we're doing here, because that guided what he next taught. He saw that they were getting an understanding now of this not self characteristic from the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. What happens if I actually develop the Eightfold Path? What happens to me? And so he gave this second teaching on saying, well, what happens to you is basically nothing because you're not letting go of anything.
He told them who you are.
He gave them the truth of who they are. Again, anatta lakana. Anatta means the not self characteristic. And so what he's teaching is that the views, and directly stated in this, the views you hold of yourself are not a self. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. Remind yourself that. When you find yourself in an agitated mind state, and that means whether it's angry or wildly elated or anything in between, and you find any type of agitation, at that point, the best way to practice restraint is to remind yourself, wait a minute, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Lisa gave such a great example of that when her eye lit on the kale chips. And she very quickly went to, this is not me, this is not mine. And then, and maybe your thinking was, well, this is simply not what I do. But it's that disassociation with compulsive thinking that allowed Lisa to maintain a calm and peaceful mind. This is not me, this is not mine.
And leave some kale chips for other people.
And leave some kale chips for other people, too.
It was really nice of me, wasn't it?
Yes.
Because they had some for dinner. They were good.
I've employed it successfully when driving in traffic.
Yeah, boy, doesn't it come up all the time, doesn't it, with that?
All the time.
Yeah. I've often felt that the world would be a better place if there was only one driver. Does everybody see now the progression from where we started, meaning the Buddha's description of awakening, through dependent origination, through the description of the Four Noble Truths, to now getting into the immediate problem of eye-making? And how this relates, most importantly, to the three marks of existence. The reason why I'm phrasing this way is because this is now pointing to the insight that's gained. And it's a very specific insight into these things called the three marks of existence. Impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting dukkha. Tonight's talk will be on the fire passion, how suffering arises from the fires of passion, self-referential passion. Helen, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just thinking the word anatta. So that word existed before.
Oh, yeah.
So how was it used prior to the Buddha's use of it?
In the Vedic/Hindu lexicon, and even later on in the Upanishads, atta was a higher self. And so anatta was not the higher self. You're not that. And that's been taken to be annihilation, meaning there's no such thing as a self. When the Buddha simply used a convenient term to say, what you think of yourself is anatta. It's not a self. And there's nothing in this separation between atta and anatta is the strong inference that there's nothing higher in those wrong views either, which leads to the idea of an inner Buddha nature or aspiring to an inner Buddhahood.
So were the Hindus using it in reference to a hierarchy of, like a structural hierarchy of wealth or power or...
All of those things. And all of those things were established in the hierarchy. In the immediate individual, it's that there's a hierarchy of consciousness that you build upon. And now think about the radicalness of the Buddha's description of anatta now. He's saying that there's nothing to build that on. It, in a sense, it completely, I don't know why I want to use the word, it completely destroyed that thinking, but he used it in a very specific way because he understood the importance of destroying that type of thinking. Mm-hmm. In a very direct way, the sutta speaks directly to that, doesn't it? What your views of a self are rooted in ignorance, they don't constitute a self in any way. And because of that, there's nothing to aspire to, because if you try to build on that, what are you building on?
Ignorance.
Building on ignorance. Mm-hmm. And again, this is another example where the Buddha was rather forceful in what he was teaching, but he was teaching it from an awakened point of view. And there wasn't any... He wasn't intolerant of the Vedas or the teachers. The teachers that taught him, Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta, he never disparaged them in any way. He simply said that those teachings don't lead to the goal that I'm after. He could have said, oh, that's a lot of nonsense, they're awful people, but he wasn't in competition with them either. There was no competition within the Buddha upon his awakening. So he simply left that in peace, but then pointed out what there... He didn't leave the teachings in peace, so did he, in that sense. Because it was important to say, the teachings are fine, I leave those in peace, I'm adding this to it. But what they teach is not the truth as far as it relates to what I'm teaching. There's no such thing as a self because it's rooted in wrong views, and because of that there's nothing to aspire to within those wrong views. Kevin?
I don't want to start a new thought if you're not done with that.
I think I'm done. That's what we do here.
I think it's remarkable out of these teachings you can really sense the Buddha's compassion and the way he teaches is an empowering way because he sort of, you know, gives the foundation of impermanence, which is where the wisdom is going to come from, and then he sort of helps, you know, his five friends here see it for themselves. It turns it back on, you know, like, now do you see what I'm trying to tell you? Yeah. You know, and it's very clear to me in that, you know, hearing this again, how he does that. It's really, really empowering, I think.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up too. You used the word compassion, and that's how I see the great compassion of this human being, because it was married with wisdom, and that gave him the courage. I used the word that he was the greatest radical of his time. I used that purposely. I think he was, and he had the courage to generate that true radicalness that was useful and effective, not to be antagonistic in any way, but to be authentic to his Dhamma. And during the Buddha, he was the only one in the beginning. I mean, everybody else saw things every other way. And most of it was rooted in the Vedas. There were some other philosophies around. The Jains were another contemporary of the Buddhas. And there's even some great suttas where the Buddha's debating, I can't remember his name. Is that the name? Nagantha's son and one of the Jains. It's a great suttas. Anyway, and again, the Buddha never denigrated anything else, but he always was insistent on saying this is what it is and it's not that, because he understood that any ambiguity at that point was the essence of hurtful behavior, the essence of wrong speech and wrong action, because he knows he's explaining this to already confused and conditioned minds, and anything that he would do that would further condition that mind is cruel, isn't it? When you know the difference.
Jains teaching the Vedas?
They taught a interesting compilation of a lot of different philosophies that were around, influenced by some of the Greek mythology even, but also rooted in the Vedas. And its primary difference, though, between what the Buddha taught and what the Jains taught comes down to their presentation of karma and rebirth.
Yeah.
and their use of extreme deprivation.
Yeah, they continued, and it continued to this day. The Jain religion is still a somewhat major religion today, and their aesthetic practices are still practiced.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting to see how the compassion of the Buddhist teaching, and how actually Buddhism disappeared from India because the later forms of Buddhism did get into what I would call a pissing contest with the Hinduistic religions and basically lost their way.
Yep.
They started arguing and they started trying to prove themselves to be better, and it's gone.
Yeah, and the Buddha even not that he was prophetizing, but he predicted that the dissolution of the Dhamma would come from within, from Dhamma practitioners practicing a false Dhamma. And that's what happened in northern India, and I would say that it's kind of what happened around the world too, even though there's still, this isn't the only Sangha that practices an authentic Dhamma, but it's one of the few that I know of. You know, it really is unique, and that's, you know, that's just the way it is. Again, I'm not saying, and I've talked to Larry a little bit about this earlier, I hope I don't give the impression that I'm against all the other Buddhist religions. I'm not. But I think it's, because of my own understanding and how that developed, I think it's vitally important to point out the differences. And people that are attached to their own view seem to have the most trouble with that. They're threatened by it. But that's just the truth. You know, it just is. The Buddha could not have possibly taught all the different modern Buddhist religions, could he? He would have been schizophrenic and suffering from multi-personality disorders in order to teach, because they're so different and contradictory. It's just not possible. And so then there's the rational argument that that's true, and these other religions developed exactly as they did through cultural and charismatic individuals over time. That's realistic. The problem is by saying, which is usually where that reverts to, is that this is what the Buddha taught, and even though they'll acknowledge that there's cultural influences, that it's rooted in what the Buddha taught. That's even possibly so, but the changes and the alterations that have been made, probably, I don't want to get into this deep discussion, have primarily been made to continue to establish, enable to the continual establishment of eye-making even within a modern Buddhist teaching. There's an article on the website called Modern Buddhism, the Thicket of Views, that gets into it. I do get into it a little bit more in the book. But that's really it was kind of shocking when I finally realized that because I was looking at why was there such great license taken to the Buddhist teaching? Why would anybody want to do it? And as I looked at it closer, I realized that most of the accommodations and adaptations and embellishments allowed for the continuance of eye-making. They allowed to practice a type of Buddhism that would ignore basic ignorance. And that's okay. That's how a lot of religions are like that.
Yeah, but Larry, you consider it a lack of compassion by not teaching to the goal.
When you know that what the Buddha taught is different, and yet you, even through tacit approval, but if you're sitting in my seat, it's cruel to not teach it accurately and authentically, at least as much as you know. Again, maybe I don't mean to be qualifying myself, but I guess that's where this is going. When I first started teaching, for the first few weeks, I was asked to teach meditation to raise some money for a person who had match practice before, Tamara Barishi. She said she was involved in this thing called the Global Alternative Healthcare Project. Would you mind teaching meditation to raise some money? So I thought, that sounds like a great idea. And because it was for charity, I thought, you know, I just want to get as many people as we can. And so the first two classes, I was a little bit cautious about what I taught and not feeling very good about it. And I realized that if I'm going to teach meditation, I have to teach it authentically as the Buddha taught. And that kind of changed it did change the focus of that beginning of the Sangha in Frenchtown.
the few people that were coming at the time, they kind of dwindled away. I think I told somebody this story last night. And there was a time I started there in October, and there was a time over that winter, I think it was February, where nobody came for a couple of weeks except this one guy who I was kind of dragging around with me. And I said, I think this is it. And if nobody's coming, there's no reason to keep doing this. Well, I mean, I'm here to raise money for charity. Why do it? And he said, I mean, he was really forceful. He said, just keep doing what you're doing for a little while longer. People will come back. And sure enough, a few people started coming back. Literally the rest is history. It's remarkable what has developed in Frenchtown. And it's not just because of me. I'm the guy sitting up here, but it's because of all of your commitment and developing the Dhamma. You know, like I said, I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't for you. And I don't think you would all be doing it if it wasn't for each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the essence of the Sangha.
So I have a question to go back.
Just one moment, because Larry had his hand up.
I just wanted to, I'm interested here at this juncture because of what was said earlier about Qigong, and also I think what Kevin was just saying is that, you know, about what, and your response to these teachings, you know, it doesn't mean that there aren't all these other wonderful things in the world.
No, not at all.
It's just that if you want to, you know, attain this awakening, and you want to end as I'm making, this is the place to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. Well said.
Yeah, if you have another issue, you know, and as I understand it, you know, in the energy in the body, there's blocked energy, there's inflammation as a result of this. There's a way to deal with that too. There's a way to cultivate the movement of it. It's going to do that just the same as there's a way here, a path here, to deal with that. So when I was also thinking about your glasses coming up on your forehead and down on your eyes and up on your forehead and down on your eyes, I didn't come here to deal with that issue. But 2 days before I came here, I had an operation on this eye, and they cut in there and they put in a lens.
How's it working?
And it's working very well, and it's working better each day. I'm looking at you, and I can see you so much more clearly than I could the first day.
Is that a good thing?
And
is that a good thing?
Yeah. Well, I'm hearing it more clearly too. But the so at any rate, I think that's it. That it's just that, you know, this isn't like, oh, okay, this is all I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah. No.
I'm going to do this in the context of a lot of other things, and there's so much benefit to so much of what we as a species it isn't like just 2,600 years ago and now there's nothing more. There have been plenty more.
Yeah. Well, I know
it's been a real benefit. Not just physically, I'm talking even spiritually in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Not the least of which is what we were talking about yesterday as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The opportunity for social engagement was the same too. I mean, there were parties and dinners, and you know, you did things, and that was fine. And finding complementary practices to your own well-being is, to me, it's part of the Dhamma, and to learn how to choose them wisely. So when somebody has some physical issues, the first person I usually think of is Matt. I don't say, you know, you're having trouble walking or you're having trouble seeing, go meditate, you'll be fine. That's foolish. And the Buddha would do the same thing. When people come to me that are in, have an extreme mental disability, that I know right off the bat that meditation is not yet ready, you know, that's not going to do it for them, I give them the name of two therapists that I know. I don't, you know, it would be cruel for me to say, all you got to do is take to the Dhamma. But here's a qualifier. As far as developing understanding and what the Buddha teaches, if you're interested in understanding the nature of dukkha, it's best to just use the Dhamma to do that. And again, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't go to Qigong, you should, or you shouldn't go to yoga, or you shouldn't maybe even use other mindfulness practices.
Or go to the eye doctor.
Or go to the eye doctor. But what you should be clear about and maintain purity about is that the Dhamma is one thing and these other things are other things. Again, that's exact, and I learned that from how the Buddha taught. So whatever wholesome activity you're involved in, continue to do it as long as it continues to serve you, but don't try to reconcile it with what the Buddha taught. That's where the problem is. Mm-hmm. And that's really the problem with modern Buddhism, but even in religion. And here I'm going to go off on a little bit of a rant. Even one of the major Buddhist teachers, and I won't name him because that's not necessary, says that that in this time we should reconcile all religions into one. We should realize that they're all one thing. And to me, that's an intolerant view. And I think that leads to some extreme behavior by people that don't want to reconcile their religion into all one thing, that amalgamation. I think that threatens people more than it encourages people. What we should be doing, and the wisdom of the Buddha was, to recognize that things are different, things are discrete. And we should be mindful to honor that discreteness and that differences. And so the Buddha often came into community with different religious leaders. But even during that community, he was very clear about what I teach is something different than what you teach. Yes, that's all. And so bringing that back to a Sangha personal level, as you continue to develop the Dhamma, what's important is to practice restraint in not doing other things, but practice restraint in trying to incorporate other things into your Dhamma practice. See it as something separate. See it as what you're doing to end your own suffering. And then when you go to a Qigong class or the eye doctor, you're doing it in a clear way. You're going to Qigong to experience an understanding of that mind-body relationship that's part of that philosophy. And it's complementary to awakening, but it's not the same thing. And when you go to the eye doctor, the Buddha's not performing the surgery. Or a higher being isn't performing. I mean, some people fool themselves that way. When you're going to the eye doctor's doing it. When for you there is no only what is there, there's only what is there. It's only what is occurring. And then you're present with what's occurring. When you try to reconcile everything into one big cosmic oneness, you lose the meaning of everything, don't you?
Yeah, it's all nice and fuzzy, but it does not lead to clarity.
It doesn't. It leads to further ignorance, and it's a great strategy to continue ignorance. We're all one. You know, it's all one thing. We're all one organism. In a physical sense, we are all one. We're connected in certain levels. You know, I always go by, you heard me say it, Carl Sagan would always say, we're all star stuff. It's true. We all had our origins, at least, you know, that's a common belief, in the explosions of stars and et cetera, and somehow it came to be that here we are in a physical life. That's all true. But it doesn't create any dhammic connection, does it? And to try to, with the modern doctrines of interdependence and interconnectedness and interbeing, just further, this is now I'm referring to how that these doctrines continue eye-making. It just furthers ignorance, because the doctrine itself is rooted in ignorance.
Well, that was hijacked for them. That oneness was hijacked into this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so... But like I was just trying to say, and I think that's the point I'm trying to get at, and I'm not probably expressing it very well, that's true too.
It is. It's absolutely true.
Yeah,
we are connected in a physical way.
Yeah.
It's just obvious. But as far as the Dhamma is concerned, it's like saying that oranges are purple. They're not, and getting into the argument is just a distraction. We could then say, well, the truth of the matter is oranges are orange. That's true. That's a true statement. And we're all interconnected by this the physicality of things.
So,
like an orange being orange has no bearing on the Dhamma, the interconnectedness in that physical sense has no bearing on the Dhamma either. It doesn't relate to awakening.
To lessening your suffering.
Yeah.
It's just a distraction to even introduce it.
So the appreciation for that is true too, but it doesn't do this.
Yep. That's right.
So, and I will name a name. So is Thich Nhat Hanh using that in a way that is detrimental to this if people interpret intervene?
I am going to speak directly, but not in the exact way that you're asking me to. Thich Nhat Hanh teaches something other than what the Buddha taught.
Yeah.
And there's nothing at all wrong with it. It's just
right.
different. And that's the difficulty that arises, because, and the only difficulty I have is it's presented as an authentic teaching of the Buddha when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Right.
Many, many people all over the world find great benefit from listening to and following and even being part of his Sangha. And that's great. But it needs to be acknowledged that what he teaches is not what the Buddha teaches.
In the context of the Buddha's teachings in the Dhamma, wouldn't it be accurate to say that we're all connected through impermanence and the first known truth? But
I think connected is even too strong of a term. We're having
sharing
a common experience.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, right.
But again, that doesn't imply that there's a connection. The only real connection that comes through awakening is understanding the nature of suffering in others and ourselves, from knowing it through ourselves. And then there's a knowledge that forms a connection that is just a natural part of awakening. It's not something we should create a doctrine over. I know you're suffering because I know my own. There's a certain emotional connection there then, isn't there? But to make more out of it is making more, just like it's going beyond. The Buddha's talking about that.
Shared experience, I like those words better.
Yeah, and just to get to Larry's point about, and again, I'm not trying to put him down, but if you really want to understand the difference and maybe qualify what I just said, do an internet search on Thich Nhat Hanh and dependent origination, and you'll see him teaching dependent origination that in no way at any time references what the Buddha taught in the Paticca-samuppada or in many other suttas. And again, so he's teaching a conceptual way of, or he's teaching a conceptual application of dependent origination that fits his type of doctrine. And it does. It fits his doctrine and what he teaches wonderfully well. It's just not what the Buddha taught. And that's the only difference I'm pointing out. So the implication would be, well, you could ask, do I follow Thich Nhat Hanh? I don't. But it's not because of any, I would say it's because of disappointment in his teachings, because I read most of his books, and I kind of wanted to be a follower of his, but when I realized it wasn't delivering in me the understanding I wanted, I looked to the source, and that made all the difference. But again, I don't have any, you know, I don't want to qualify it any further except to say again, it's just different. More?
No, I was also going to point out, but I don't know that it's helpful, is that then he has further adapted foundations of mindfulness it has become its own doctrine,
mm-hmm.
and reinterpretation and adaptation to particular issues of quote unquote modern times, and that's what it is.
That's what it is, yeah.
That's what it is.
You could say that his adaptations were in response to what is occurring in the world, but also when you look closely and you learn about the life he had as a child, you can see that there's the adaptations were made as a coping mechanism for the incredible trauma he went through as a little boy. Bombs going off around him when he's 5 years old, not knowing what's going to hit him. I mean, that, you know, he lived with that. And so his adaptations to the Dhamma, you can see, fit into that type of trauma. Moore mentioned his teachings on mindfulness. He teaches them, again, as part of the four foundations of mindfulness, but in no way do they relate to the Satipatthana Sutta. And that's a common practice of taking the understood phrase, dependent origination, dependent co-arising, four foundations of mindfulness, and turning it in to fit something else. And even his application, Thich Nhat Hanh's basic application is mindfulness. And not much of anything else. And again, I'm not putting him down, but that's what he teaches. You know. And thank you for bringing it up. Again, I'm not trying to denigrate the man. I think he's a wonderful, incredible human being.
No, I only brought it up because I think I understand it in the context of what's being discussed better, which is helpful.
Yeah.
Differentiating, not denigrating.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that. You'll find, for those of you that are a little bit newer, you'll probably be drawn to look
more into Buddhism, and you might start studying Zen Buddhism or Tibetan or the other ones, and that's great. You might even gain some understanding or some helpful direction. Just remember that it's different. That's all. It's like there's nothing wrong with going to read James Keating, for those of you who know who he is. He's a wonderful writer. He has a very strong Christian bent to him. There's nothing wrong with reading about him. Or any of the other great Christian mystics. Their words are beautiful. It's wonderful to read them. Just understand that what they're teaching is not what the Buddha taught. That's all. And that way, we're living truly mindful. We're able to discern what is Dhamma practice, what leads to awakening, and what is oftentimes a beautiful explanation of what's occurring around us through a certain point of view.
Right now.
Right now, yeah.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.